But what, says Jansenius, if Augustine before me has maintained this same theory, that we must necessarily do that which pleases us most according to the well-known passage, it is necessary that we act according to that which delights us most. Now, before we answer Jansenius, we must premise that St. Augustine, who had to confute several heresies of his time, all on the subject of grace, and all contrary to one another, had to speak of it diffusely and upon different points of view, and is therefore in several places obscure. Hence it has come to pass that not only each of the Catholic schools boasts of having him on its side, though their opinions are quite different, but also Calvin and Jansenius, whose errors have been condemned by the Church, have presumed to call him their patron. Calvin, writing against Fagius, says, "We follow nothing but Augustine. Fagius may speak as he pleases. He will never make us allow that Augustine is not on our side." And Jansenius puts forward Augustine as his sole teacher, so that he even called his book by the title of Augustinius. And the Jansenists only call themselves Augustinians. From these premises, we only wish to infer that many passages of St. Augustine require explanation by comparison with other passages of his works, where he declares his true opinion if we would not be misled. Now let us come to the point. We have already explained at the beginning that this sentence of St. Augustine ought not and cannot be understood of indeliberate pleasure antecedent to any cooperation of the will, but ought to be understood of deliberate and consequent pleasure. For in cases where man freely consents to the pleasure, then certainly it is necessary that he should act upon it. And this is proved by what Augustine says in other places, where he confounds pleasure with love, or rather explains that the superior pleasure is nothing else than that deliberate love, and that affection which by our own free choice predominates in us, in which pleasure, if we deliberately take delight, then it is necessary that we act upon it. So that in substance, he simply says that the will must act upon that which it deliberately loves the most. For in one place he says that the pleasure is, as it were, the weight of the soul, which drags it along with it. For pleasure is, as it were, the weight of the soul, he said. And in another place, that this weight which draws each man's soul is his love. My love is my weight. This he explains more clearly in another place, where he says, we ought to be careful, by God's help, to be so disposed as not to be tripped up by inferior things, and to take pleasure only in the higher things. See how clearly he speaks of deliberate pleasure freely accepted. In another place, what is it to be drawn by pleasure? To delight in the Lord, and he will give thee the petitions of thy heart. Again, see how the Father draws. He delights us by teaching, not by laying us under necessity. Again, if we wish to enjoy the pleasures of heaven, we must bridle unlawful pleasure, as when we fast, the appetite rises against us. This it does by pleasure, in other words, indeliberate. But we restrain it by the law of the governing reason. So that according to St. Augustine, the pleasure which incites us to break the law may be freely repressed by man by means of the dominant reason and by the help of grace. Hence he exhorts us, let justice so delight you as to conquer even lawful pleasures. This is made still clearer by the context of the passage on which we are now disputing, where, after saying, we must needs act upon the greater pleasure, he adds, it is clear that our life must be according to our pursuits, and our pursuits must be according to our affections. Mark this. Therefore, if there are two contradictory things, the command of justice and the carnal habit, and both of them are loved, we shall pursue that which we love most. So that when he says we must needs act according to that which delights us most, he only means that the will must necessarily act on that which it loves best. Nor will it do to say, with Jansenius, that what gives most pleasure is most loved, for this is not always true. And St. Augustine expressly contradicts it when in his Confessions he says of himself, I did not do that in which my affections took incomparably more pleasure, and which, as soon as I would, I could do. By which he means that he was already moved by God with an indeliberate affection, which made virtue incomparably more pleasant to him than vice, and that he might easily have been virtuous if he would, but that he resisted grace and refused to be virtuous, and abandoned himself to vice. Further, if St. Augustine had believed that it was necessary for us to act upon the greater pleasure, he could never have said, when the unlawful pleasure of concupiscence tickles you, fight, resist, do not consent, and the saying is fulfilled, go not after thy desires. Still further, he says elsewhere, that of two persons who have the same temptation to impurity, it sometimes happens that one consents to it and the other resists. And why? Because, he says, one wills to observe chastity, the other wills not. If both are tempted by the same, mark the word same, temptation, and one yields and consents to it, while the other perseveres, what else is shown but that one willed to fail, the other willed not to fail in chastity? Moreover, when he says that it is necessary that we should act upon that which best pleases us, it may be asked whether he speaks of deliberate or indeliberate pleasure. Now we say that if he had meant indeliberate pleasure, he would have been obliged, in consequence, to deny that the will, in order to be truly free, need be free not only from violence, but also from necessity. But there are 1,000 places where he teaches the reverse, and says that man, whether in good or in evil, acts without necessity. Therefore, when he speaks of the predominant pleasure overcoming, he must necessarily mean the deliberate or consequent pleasure. To quote a few of the numerous passages, our will would be no will at all if it were not in our own power, for that is not free to us which we have not in our power. In another place, speaking of the passage of St. Matthew, where our Lord talks of good fruit springing from a good tree and bad fruit from a bad tree, he says, when therefore our Lord says this, or do that, he shows that it is in the power of man to do it, for he that will not keep the law can keep it if he will. Calvin objects that Augustine is here speaking of man in the state of innocence. But Bellarmine well observes that St. Augustine is here explaining a passage where our Lord is speaking against the Jews and says of them, ye shall know them by their fruits. So that it can never be supposed that St. Augustine meant to apply the remark to Adam. Moreover, he repeats what he had said against the Manichees when writing against the Pelagians, whatever it is said, do not this and do not that, and whenever an act of will is required of us to do or not to do something which God commands or forbids, in such places the will is shown to be sufficiently free. Here Jansenius replies, like a partisan of Calvin as he is, that St. Augustine is speaking of necessity violently imposed on us, not of simple necessity. But here again Jansenius is mistaken, for on this point St. Augustine agreed with the Pelagians and conceded to them that the will was free both from coercive and from simple necessity. Hence in this book against Julian he did not scruple to say, both of us affirm that the will in man is free. But you say that anyone is free to do good without God's help, hence you are a Pelagian. When St. Augustine says both of us affirm, he admitted the same liberty to do or not to do which the Pelagians maintained, and they certainly maintained to be exempt from any necessity whatever, so that there is no doubt that he held the will to be free not only from violence, but from any necessity whatever. He only contradicted the Pelagians in this point, that they maintain the will to be free to do good even without grace. Further, St. Augustine says that it is difficult to reconcile the liberty of the will with the efficacy of grace. This question, wherein we discuss the choice of the will and the grace of God, is so difficult to determine that when we defend free will, we seem to deny the grace of God. And when we assert the grace of God, we are supposed to destroy free will. If St. Augustine had supposed that the will was not free from simple necessity, but only from violence, it would not have been difficult, but the easiest thing possible, to understand how grace acted. When therefore he said that it was difficult to understand, it was because he held that efficacious grace certainly produced its effect in good acts, and on the other hand, that the will did these acts freely, working without any necessity to prevent it from being able to do so, or to wish any acts different from those to which it was moved by grace. For the rest, the Holy Father held it as certain that man, with the help of ordinary grace, was able to fulfill the commandments, or at any rate to procure by prayer greater help to enable him to fulfill them. Otherwise, as he said, God would not have imposed these commandments on him, nor would he have commanded us to do this if he had considered it impossible to be done by man. We will quote some more passages of St. Augustine, where he reiterates the doctrine that the will of man is free from any necessity, for that would not be sin which was not done by the will, and therefore punishment would also be unjust if man had not free will, that is, if he acted well or ill through necessity. Again, who would not exclaim that it is folly to give commands to a man who is not free to do what is commanded, and that it is injustice to condemn the man who had no power to fulfill the command? Again, if the motion whereby the will turns aside from the unchangeable good is natural and necessary, it can by no means be culpable. Then, after saying that previous grace is necessary to enable us to do good, he adds, but to consent to the call of God or to dissent from it is in the power of our own will. Here he plainly teaches that the will can freely obey grace or resist it. Nor does it avail to any to say with Jansenius that St. Augustine only means that to consent and dissent is the proper office of the will. For we can never believe that the holy doctor would have taken such useless pains to prove that consent and dissent belong to the will and not to the intellect, a thing which any illiterate man can tell. Especially as St. Augustine's words, just before the last quoted sentence, are as follows: no one has it in his power to determine what shall come into his mind, but to consent, etc. So that it is clear that he is speaking of the free power of the will to consent or dissent from that which comes into the head. In another place he says, no one but God can make the tree. He is speaking of the good trees that produce good fruit and of the bad trees which produce bad fruit. But every man's will has power to choose either good or bad. When therefore our Lord says, do this or do that, he shows that it is in man's power to choose what to do. Elsewhere, in explanation of the help sine qua, he says, without it, the will cannot will, but still it is left to the free will either to will or not to will, to use the help or not to use it. From all this, it is very clearly seen how far St. Augustine was from the opinion of Jansenius that the will of man in its action is not free from necessity, much less that it is obliged to follow the preponderating pleasure, which by its impulse invincibly moves and determines it. Now let us apply this to the point we have in view, namely to prove that God gives everyone either proximate grace or the remote grace of prayer to enable him to observe the precepts, since otherwise the transgression of the law would never be imputed to him as a fault. Let us then see what are the two propositions that are exactly opposite to those of Jansenius. His first is, some precepts of God are impossible to the just man who wishes and tries to fulfill them with his present strength, nor does God give him grace to make them possible. Hence the Catholic proposition, contradictory of this, is as follows. Not any of the precepts of God is impossible, at least to the just man, who wishes to observe them and who endeavors to do so. Nor, even with his present strength, is he without the grace, either proximate or at least remote, whereby he may at least obtain greater assistance to enable him to fulfill them. And here we must again observe that to avoid the condemned error, it is not enough to grant the absolute possibility of observing the precept, for the Jansenists themselves admit this possibility, but we must also admit the possibility, relatively to the actual carnal delectation which preponderates over the delectation of grace, to fulfill the commandment when it is incumbent on us to do so, or at least to obtain grace to keep it, since the error of Jansenius consists precisely in denying not the absolute, but the relative possibility. Jansenius' third proposition is that, in order to merit ill or well in the state of fallen nature, man need not have freedom from necessity, but only freedom from compulsion. Hence the Catholic proposition is the contradictory. To merit ill or well, even in the state of fallen nature, man, whether just or unjust, requires freedom not only from compulsion, but also from simple necessity, since according to the Catholic doctrine, the voluntary, whenever it is necessary, is not free in such a sense as is sufficient to merit ill or well in this life. But to merit ill or well, the will must be free from any necessity whatever of being obliged to consent to either of two things determinately. Moreover, F. Fortunato de Brescia, a man universally celebrated by the learned of these days, especially by Moratori, in his late work entitled Confutation of the System of Cornelius Jansenius, says that if this system could possibly be true, God's law would be either foolish or unjust. For according to it, if the heavenly pleasure predominates, then the will, quite independently of the law, is obliged to follow the precise impulse of the pleasure, and thus the law is useless. Or if the earthly pleasure predominates, then the law is unjust, for God imposes a commandment which it is physically impossible for man to obey, since the will must necessarily yield to the temptation. And in this way, all the threats and admonitions of the scriptures would be useless, and there would be no human action which could merit reward or punishment, since all the actions of man would be done through necessity. So that whenever anyone exhorted us to do well, we might answer with Eusebius against the fatalist, "These powers are not mine, O doctor, for they will do it if the fate so desire," in other words, if the carnal delight does not preponderate. That which is fated will necessarily come to pass. I must necessarily follow the pleasure that prevails. The same author says further that if we admit this system, we must also admit Manichaeism, which supposes two principles, a good and an evil, and says that as all the acts of men were derived from one or the other principle, the man was obliged to follow that which prevailed. Nor does it do to say that the necessity in the system of the preponderating pleasure is not derived from the good or evil principle, as the Manichaeans held, but depends on the sin of Adam, which is its cause. For the question is not through what principle the will acts necessarily when it is moved, but whether the will after Adam's fall has remained free from necessity in its actions. And this is what the Jansenists deny, who hold that the will merits well and ill, though it is necessitated to will that to do which the preponderating pleasure determines it. But as F. Fortunato well observes, the books of Arnold, Irene, Ventroccio, and the other Jansenists were condemned for this very error of maintaining Jansenius' principle of the invincibility of the pleasure which is superior in degree. And we know that it was for this reason that the theology of Giovannino was prohibited. For though he did not expressly hold the system we are discussing, yet he imprudently spoke too obscurely on the point. The physical nature of efficacious grace consists simply in the preponderance of the pleasure which the mind takes in goodness. Still, he did not use the phrase relatively preponderating, though he proves his proposition by the oft-quoted text of St. Augustine, "We must act according to that which pleases us most." And for this cause, his work was so long prohibited, and has at last been allowed because of the addition of a compendium entitled The True Doctrine of the Church, extracted from the theology of Thornley, who has amply and well confuted the system. F. Fortunatoan concludes, "It is clear, then, that the system of Jansenius is favorable to them, Luther and Calvin, and so cannot be maintained by a Catholic without violating his faith. For we cannot preserve our faith and religion while defending a system on the admission of whose fundamental principles the reception of condemned doctrines necessarily follows." Thornley meant the same when he said, "Since the Church condemned the five propositions in the sense of Jansenius, they must be condemned as part of Jansenius' theory of the superior and relatively preponderating pleasure, which is the foundation of his whole system." Nor will it avail to say that the system of Jansenius is one thing, which supposes that the pleasure which relatively preponderates is indeliberate, that is, that it comes to us without any assent of the will, for that it is quite a different thing to say that the pleasure, though it relatively preponderates by the superiority of its degree, yet is deliberate, that is, it preponderates not by itself and by its own strength, as the maintainers of this system say, but it preponderates by being reinforced by the power of the consenting will. And hence they say that though the preponderating pleasure certainly and infallibly overcomes, yet it does not do so necessarily, as Jansenius maintained. This will not avail because, as Thornley well replies, that grace or that pleasure which is infallibly efficacious and invincibly determines the will by its preponderating power cannot but necessitate the will to consent. And he proves it thus. That grace necessitates, which supposes the will to be destitute of real power to resist it. But of this nature is grace, which is infallibly efficacious, because of the superiority of the degree of its strength. For grace of this kind supposes that the will has only inferior strength to resist, but it is in contradiction to say that superior strength, acting as such, can be overcome by inferior. Otherwise, it would be necessary that the inferior strength should act beyond the degree of its power of acting. Nor does it avail to reply that though the power of grace, relatively preponderating, is superior to that of the concupiscence taken by itself, it is not superior to that of the concupiscence joined with that of the will. Because, as Thornley says, such a power of the will could only be admitted with respect to evil, which a man can do by himself, as when he overcomes one vice by another, or at least with respect to good of the natural order, but not with respect to supernatural good, such as the conquest of a strong concupiscence, which cannot be effected without God's grace. Hence the fathers of Diospolis required every Pelagian, among other things, to confess that when we fight against temptations and unlawful concupiscence, the victory comes not from our own will, but from the help of God. And the reason is, as St. Thomas teaches, that no active principle can produce an effect exceeding the sphere of its activity, so that no natural principle or cause can produce a supernatural effect. No act exceeds the proportion of its active principle, and hence we see that in natural things nothing can, by its own operation, produce an effect which exceeds the power of its activity, but can only, by its own operation, produce an effect proportionate to its power. So that the natural power of the human will, although united to the power of grace, cannot, when the latter is inferior to the power of the concupiscence, contribute to produce a supernatural effect, such as the conquest of a violent concupiscence that preponderates over grace. And in fact, the Jansenists say, "We are contented if you grant to us that the delectation certainly overcomes by reason of its superior power." See how one of them, the Abbot de Bourget, speaks, "It is sufficient for us, if this single truth be granted, that as often as we consent to the grace of God, it always arises from the right love which God inspires, being superior in strength, to the perverse love, and in consequence of this superiority, always most certainly overcoming it. Hence Turnley, speaking of the two systems, of pleasure absolutely preponderating and of pleasure relatively preponderating, concludes, "We have known orthodox theologians who test efficacious grace by its pleasure being absolutely and simply preponderating over all other pleasures, and who call that sufficient grace which has just power enough to overcome the lust actually opposed to it. But we have only met with Jansenists who maintain that no grace can overcome unless it is relatively preponderating in degree, and who admit no other sufficient grace than one that is inferior in strength to the superior concupiscence which opposes it." So that, to conclude, we do not intend now to blame the opinion that the will, even when it follows the greater delectation, yet always acts freely, that is, without necessity, and with true power, not merely nominal or hypothetical power, to act in a contrary way. But we only reject the opinion of those who say that when one of the two pleasures, the carnal or the heavenly, preponderates by being greater in degree than the other, then man has no more power to resist and to overcome it, because the greater force always overcomes the less. Nevertheless, I cannot in this place neglect to mention the difficulty that I find in this system of the preponderating delectation. Its defendants say, as also F. John Lawrence Bertie, that the efficacy of grace, as they maintain it, does not differ in substance from the efficacy as taught by the Thomists, though founded on different principles. For the Thomists make the efficacy of grace consist in a physical predetermination, but the Jansenist in the preponderating pleasure. That which is done by physical premonition, according to the Thomists, the same is done by victorious delectation, according to the Augustinians. Namely, the liberty of the will is moved to give consent in actu secundo. Further, both opinions teach that man still has the power, in actu primo, to act in opposite directions, so that the will always acts freely and without necessity. But I observe that as the principles and the reasons of these two opinions are different, so also are their consequences. According to the Thomists, the reasons of the efficacy of grace is because the created will is in a state of passive potentiality, able to receive the motions of grace, so that to come to actual operation it must be moved by God as the first agent and first free cause, who by his predetermination adapts and determines the potentiality of the will into actuality. This only relates to the act, but as for the power of capability, the Thomists say that man has the grace of potentiality wholly complete and in proximate preparation, so as to be able to act virtuously. Thus, F. Gonet, "the grace which gives the power gives the full complement and all the strength or sufficiency which is requisite, so far as the actus primus is concerned." So also Cardinal Gotti, "sufficient grace gives proximate power and complete power within the limits of potentiality." And thus all other Thomists in general, and if any of them apparently speak otherwise, it is only of the actus secundus, not primus. On the other hand, the reason of the principle of those who maintain the opinion of the pleasure superior in degree is because, as they say, whereas at first, in the state of innocence, man only required sufficient grace to do well, since his will, being then sound and in perfect balance, could easily act with only sufficient grace, without needing efficacious grace. Now, on the other hand, since the fall of Adam, the will, being injured and inclined to evil, has need of efficacious grace, which by means of the victorious pleasure adapts it for acting virtuously. But, I say, according to this reason for the system, granting that the will of man has become so weak that in its present state it cannot act without efficacious grace, it is impossible to say that man still has, by virtue of sufficient grace, not even in the actus primus, nor either in the sensuous compositus, nor sensus divisus, the complete and proximately prepared power to observe the commandments, or to be able to do any good work, even though it be mediate, by means of which he can place himself in a position to obtain greater help to enable him to fulfill the law. I know that the supporters of this opinion have no objection to grant this, and to say that in our present state sufficient grace does not give complete and prepared power. Sufficient grace, says F. Macedo, one of this school, does not give power approximately complete and prepared. And elsewhere, speaking of the grace of Adam innocent and of Adam fallen, he says, the first supposed a power prepared and free, the second a power crippled, hindered, and enslaved. So supposing that grace, when inferior to the concupiscence, does not give complete and prepared power to observe the commandments, it can in truth be no longer called sufficient. So that, in fact, F. Bertie, who defends such a system of the relatively victorious delectation, finds no difficulty in further granting that such inferior grace ought properly to be called inefficacious and not sufficient. So that on this system, they who do not receive from God grace that is efficacious, by means of the delectation relatively victorious over that of the concupiscence, have not even grace sufficient to enable them to fulfill the commandments. F. Bertie thus writes in defense of his opinion. First, he states the three objections of his opponents, which are as follows. There are three things which savor the Jansenist dogma and are the fountain and source of the five condemned propositions, to which the new Jansenists, the chief of whom are two, doubtless pretended, Augustinians, make no objection. These two are F. Bellelli and F. Bertie, against whom the Archbishop of Vienne wrote. The first of these three things is that they do not make efficacious grace consist simply in a victorious delectation, but in a delectation relatively preponderating. The second is that they deny the existence of a power proximately prepared in the case of a delectation of a lower grade, requiring for this, as regards the power and the actus primus, a stronger delectation, and therefore inefficacious grace, or the assistance sine qua which they preach about, is not really sufficient grace, either in the Molinist sense or the Thomist sense, since sufficient grace, by the common consent of Catholics, confers power proximately prepared. The third thing that follows from this is that they deny the existence of such a thing as sufficient grace, the very name of which they fraudulently abstain from using, and call it rather inefficacious than insufficient. Such are the objections. Now for F. Bertie's answer, I most firmly and unhesitatingly declare that the three doctrines just cited are no way erroneous, nor principles of the five condemned propositions, but that some people, moved indeed by a laudable zeal for refuting Jansenius, but nevertheless carried away by the prejudice of their private judgment, have made no distinction between what is Catholic and what is erroneous and condemned, and that from these people's lucubrations some anonymous Sialite, the Archbishop of Vienne to wit, and some other men of scanty learning and fat wits, have taken occasion to calumniate the unshaken doctrines of Augustine, which, whether they admit it or not, are the same as ours, as monstrous heresies. Now I confess myself also to be precisely one of these scantily learned and gross-minded men, for I cannot understand how the propositions of F. Bertie hold together, since in their consequences they appear clearly repugnant to one another. If he had said that to observe the divine law we have need of efficacious grace, but that sufficient grace, which is given to all, gives the proximate power to enable us to pray, and by prayer to obtain the greater assistance necessary for the actual observance of the commandments, we should quite agree, for this is our opinion, but we shall set forth and prove in the next chapter. But we cannot agree, because while speaking of prayer, he says well that every one of the faithful, by means of this sufficient grace, if he puts no impediment in the way, can pray, and by prayer obtain the immediate assistance to enable him actually fulfill the commandments. To each of the faithful, these are his words, unless he freely puts an obstacle in the way, the grace of prayer is given by which he may obtain the aid immediately sufficient to fulfill the commandments. And further, he says, in another place, that the said sufficient grace common to all the faithful, although not only remotely sufficient for the observance of the precepts, is nevertheless proximately sufficient for prayer, by which efficacious grace is then obtained. In him who has the little will, that is, the will which is furnished by the sufficient grace, there is a power proximately sufficient for prayer, and remotely sufficient for the observance of the commandments, which he will be able proximately to fulfill, when by prayer he has obtained a strong will, which strong will is furnished by efficacious grace. He says then, and says wisely, that for the observance of the commandments it cannot be said that sufficient grace gives to all the proximate power actually to fulfill them. For, as he well observes in the place just cited, the proximate power to observe the precepts is that which needs nothing further to enable it to act. Hence he writes in the same section, near the beginning, that the complete and prepared power can only be had from efficacious grace. Efficacious grace alone gives the complete and ready power. Hence he adds that in order that the sufficient grace may be said to be proximately sufficient for actual operation, it is requisite that it should not need any further means in order to act. So that according to the reasoning of F. Bertie, though the sufficient grace does not supply all the faithful with proximate power to keep the commandments, yet it supplies all with power proximately sufficient to pray. Therefore, each of the faithful, by the aid of sufficient grace alone, can actually pray without the need of any further assistance, that is, of efficacious grace. But then, I do not know how this agrees with what he says in another place. No one without grace, efficacious in itself, has the power of praying united with the act. Therefore, according to this second proposition, the sufficient grace does not give really, but only in name, the power proximately sufficient for prayer. It only gives the power remotely sufficient, if there is need of efficacious grace to make the power of praying issue and act. Either, therefore, for actual prayer, efficacious grace is requisite, and then it cannot be said that the sufficient grace gives the power proximately sufficient, or else sufficient grace gives the power proximately sufficient for actual prayer, and then there is no need of the efficacious grace of the preponderating pleasure which he seeks to establish. But St. Augustine also, says F. Bertie, requires an overpowering pleasure to enable us to pray. Augustine teaches that for prayer a certain knowledge is requisite and an overpowering pleasure. I have examined the passage referred to, which is as follows. Let us understand, if we can, that the good Lord God sometimes does not give even to his saints either the certain knowledge of some good work or an overpowering delight in it, in order that they may understand that the light wherewith their darkness is enlightened comes not from themselves, but from him. And so also the sweetness by which their land yields its fruit. St. Augustine does not say that an overpowering delight is requisite for prayer. He only says that sometimes God does not give even to his saints either the certain knowledge or the overpowering delight of some just work, in order that they may know that from him, and not from themselves, they have the light to illumine them, and the sweetness to make them bear fruit. Therefore, St. Augustine does not here primarily speak of the sufficient grace by which a man can work, but does not always work, nor does he say that man with only sufficient grace and without efficacious grace cannot actually pray. But he speaks only of efficacious grace, which, by means of an overpowering delight, infallibly causes him to do well. Secondly, he does not speak here of prayer, but of just works, which properly means the observance of the precepts or of the counsels, since prayer, though it is good work, of its own nature is not a work, but the means of obtaining the aid necessary to execute good works. We also hold, as we said before, that efficacious grace is necessary for the observance of the commandments. But we say that for actual prayer, whereby we may obtain efficacious grace, the sufficient grace which God gives to all the faithful is enough. And thus we do no violence to the truth that God's commandments are not impossible to anyone, since every man, by means of the sufficient grace only, can perform such an easy thing as prayer. And by means of prayer he will obtain the assistance of gratuitous, efficacious grace, which is necessary for the actual performance of difficult things, such as the observance of the commandments. Thus says Cardinal Norris, whose words I will quote in the next chapter, and before him St. Augustine, by the fact that we most firmly believe that God does not command impossibilities, we are admonished in easy matters what to do, and in difficult matters what to ask for. Otherwise, if sufficient grace were not enough for actual prayer, and the addition of efficacious grace were always necessary, and if this were denied to any man, as in fact efficacious grace is denied to many, I cannot see how the commandments of God could be said to be possible to such a person, and how God could demand of him the observance of his law, at the time when he denies him even the efficacious grace to enable him actually to pray, and how with justice he could condemn him to hell for not observing it. This is precisely that which made Jansenius say that some precepts were impossible even from the first, because he erroneously said that some men want the grace to make the precepts possible to them. But it is not so, because God gives to all men. We are not here considering the case of infidels and obstinate sinners, the proximate grace to enable them actually to pray, as we shall prove in the next chapter. And so no one will be able to make the excuse that the observance of the precepts was impossible to him, for though he had not efficacious grace for their actual observance, he had nevertheless grace proximately sufficient for actual prayer, by means of which he would have obtained from God efficacious grace, according to his promise of hearing whoever prays to him. And with this he certainly might have observed the precepts. And the Council of Trent has expressly declared this against Luther, who asserted that the observance of God's law was impossible even to the faithful. God, it says, does not command impossibilities, but by commanding he admonishes you to do what you can, and to ask for what you cannot do, and by his help he enables you to do it. Please fast forward and go to side B.